Good afternoon. I'd like to present an international team featuring a rare combination of both security experts and academics who are here to present the first meaningful real-world attack on MD5. So, please.
Hi, and thank you for having us. I'm Jake Applebaum, and this is Mark Stevens, and this is Alex Sudaroff. And today we're going to talk about MD5 and how it should be considered harmful today, and how we've created a rogue CA certificate. And so we're also joined here by David Molnar, and we also have over here on the very far left, Bene, is that, yes. So, and also Arjen on the right. And so Alex and I are the security researchers, and these guys are the academics. So just to, you know, in case, these are the organizations in which we're from. So essentially, we noticed that real certificate authorities actually still issue certificates signed with MD5. And this is something that's quite incredible, since MD5 has been known to be broken since 2004. So there was a theoretical certificate authority attack published in 2007. Can I get a show of hands of people here that saw that or heard about that? Okay, so the people that did that attack are the academics up here. So it seemed like a great idea to collaborate. So what we were able to do while collaborating here was that we were able to, as I said, create a rogue certificate authority, and it allows us to do completely transparent man-in-the-middle attacks on anything that uses SSL. This isn't a specific critique against SSL. This is about digital signatures, and we're using SSL as an example, specifically because of the real-world use. So the way that we did this was with MD5 chosen prefix collisions and a cluster of 200 PlayStation 3s. Funded by the Swiss taxpayers. Thank you for your neutrality. That's very good. So what we're going to talk about in this is essentially split up, as you see right here. And I'm going to now tell you about a live demo. This is our backup demo, because our previous demo had a problem. It worked, so we tried to change it. What can I say? Go Linux. If you can reach .3 on MD5 Collisions, Inc., on the wireless network, you can try to man-in-the-middle yourself live for every single site on the internet, if you would like, specifically on port 443. Please don't burn your remote roots on this machine. Thanks. But you can also go to this URL right there and check out the certificate chain. And the certificate chain should be of interest to you. You'll need to set your clock back to August 2004, because we intentionally crippled the certificate. This is not a limitation of our attack, but specifically because we wanted to limit a number of things that could possibly go wrong. But please understand that we set the expiration to 2004. This was not the certificate authority. So we could have easily set it to expire in 2038, for example. So we're going to talk about public key infrastructure. So basically, SSL is used for, who here doesn't use SSL? Raise your hand. Okay, that's good. All of you use SSL. Excellent. Okay, so the attack tool that that I wrote basically works by man-in-the-middling all the connections and simply relaying them and issuing certificates based on what the opposite side of the connection has in its certificates. So POP3 and IMAP, as well as IRC SSL, fell over instantly. It was very easy to write extra, basically no code to do this, and it just works perfectly out of the box. And using this, it's been really interesting because we've also found hilarious bugs, like IRSSI actually doesn't care if the certificate chain is expired. So it's maybe not the world's greatest thing. SSL is, of course, used all over the world for lots of other things other than these examples, and basically, if you have the trust root in your certificate store that we have compromised here, you're perhaps in trouble. And if you have MD5 certificate authorities, those that issue certificates with MD5, that's maybe not the world's greatest thing. So essentially, it allows for everything that is your worst nightmare. And there's a lot of talk about what could possibly happen if you know we hadn't had SSL with the big Kaminsky DNS bug. So this combined with that is almost like unimaginably bad, I suppose. Firefox 3 is really interesting. It has 135 trusted certificate authority certs. So like Turk Telecom, just for example, I think has like 3 or something like this. If you look at it, you'll see that the certificates aren't constrained in any way. So any of those certificate authorities can issue for anybody. And that's not so great. And the CA supposedly has this responsibility to make sure that when you request a certificate, you are who you say you are. But this doesn't always work out well. There's a high-profile incident where Microsoft.com certificates were issued by VeriSign to like some unknown party. And this can be a really big problem. But that's just one certificate. So just having a single certificate is not necessarily the end of the world, except for a specific targeted attack, maybe. But as far as having the ability to have a certificate authority below that, it means that you can issue them for anything, and you only need to pull the attack off once. That's the real key thing. So they're supposedly also supposed to be responsible for revocation, but if you remember the Debian OpenSSL bug, you probably know that that didn't work out very well. So here's basically the idea here for those watching at home. Essentially, we've got the root CAs, and then some of them delegate out trust. Just a couple days ago, there was a Startcom blog post that talked about how a guy was able to get a Mozilla.com certificate. And the way that he did it was by simply saying he was Mozilla.com, and some reseller that didn't do any sort of like validation of his credentials simply issued him Mozilla.com, totally valid. Of course, it wasn't a CA, but you know that's not bad if you wanted to specifically attack Mozilla. And so this complicates matters as far as checking certificates. So essentially, you know, if anybody here has ever generated a certificate signing request, you know that basically the steps are that you need to have your domain name, you've got like the information you fill out that the certificate authority requires of you, and it has the public key. The CA basically will take this certificate signing request, it parses it and it says, okay, this is, you know, foxnews.com. I'm going to check that out somehow. Usually it looks by sending an email to hostmaster at the domain or something like this, and you have to click a little link and maybe solve a CAPTCHA or something like that. And if you pass their checks, then they give you a certificate. And then you, as the user, will, of course, take that legitimately and put your private key and the certificate in place. And in theory, this is a great idea. And this is where we'd like to introduce our secret weapon, Mark.
Hi, yes. Now I'm going to sketch a little bit about MD5 and the attacks that have been against it. And, well, as you know, MD5 is a hash function and was originally designed in 1991. And it's basically an iterative design using a compression function. So it picks a message and it splits up in blocks and then it will just process it sequentially, all those blocks, until finally you get the hash value. And so basically what we're working with are collisions. So that means that there are different messages that have the same MD5 hash. So the first MD5 collision attack was presented in 2004 by a Chinese team of researchers. And they were able to create collisions, two messages of only 128 collision bytes, and that had the same hash. Currently, this attack can actually be done within 1 second on a regular PC. This collision attack is quite limited because the only difference that you have between the colliding messages are those 128 collision bytes, and that can be anywhere in the messages. The messages themselves can be very large, but the only difference between them can be in 128 consecutive bytes. So what can you do with this kind of collision attacks? Well, for a collision attack, you can do this attack, generate specific collision blocks somewhere in a file, and you can use a document format. For instance, there was an example with the PostScript files, and PostScript supports like an if-then-else statement, and it just compared which collision block was present, then it showed one contents, and in the other case, it showed the other contents. So, and that's the case for this attack. If you use an if-then-else construction, both payloads must be present in both files, and that's quite a restriction. So there were these colliding PostScript files that were done in this way, but other documents are also, it's also possible to do this attack for like Word documents and PDF files. Also colliding executables examples have been shown, and well, of course, both payloads have to be in there, but the two different messages have different execution flows. Now, in 2007, our chosen prefix collision attack came up, and it's a much stronger collision attack. And because in the earlier attack, only 128 bytes can differ. With our chosen prefix collision, basically almost the entire message can be different. So, like the picture shows, you can just pick the first part of the message any way you like, for both kinds. You can choose them both freely, and then we just add 716 collision bytes, and there it is, there is an MD5 collision. And whatever you append after it, if they are equal, it remains an MD5 collision. And such a chosen prefix collision currently only takes one day on a single PlayStation 3 and a PC. So what can you do with this chosen prefix collisions? Well, this is a second generation attack scenarios order. You don't need if-then-else statements necessary in these document formats. So that means that each file just contains the single payload instead of both. Well, with regards to colliding executables, this means that the malicious payload will not be present in the harmless executable. So it will not be obvious that there is any harm in this harmless executable. And also, this also applies to documents where these collision blocks, to make them collide, can just be put inside raw image data in an image that won't even show in the document. So how are we going to use these chosen prefix collisions, or MD5 collisions, to generate colliding certificates? Well, if certificates consist of two parts, the to-be-signed part and the signature itself. So if the to-be-signed parts collide, then the signatures will be identical for both certificates. So how can you use it? Well, you generate a pair of colliding certificates with the colliding to-be-signed parts. You get the legitimate certificate signed, and now you can copy the signature into the rogue certificate. So in previous work, the first collision attack, the 2004 collision attack, colliding certificates were made, but yeah, those 128 different bytes were only in the RSA public key. So the identities in both certificates were exactly the same, so this wasn't really, really impressive. Now in 2006, with our chosen prefix collisions, we could just take whatever identities we wanted and use the RSA public key to make them collide, and then we had colliding certificates with different identity. And these chosen prefix collisions have been known since 2007. So this is kind of the attack you would have with a 2004 collision, the chosen prefix collision attack from 2006. So you just have two certificates. The red parts are the chosen prefix, and that will contain the different identities. And on the left side, you will have a serial number and a validity period, and it just falls off the screen, that are set by the CA. But on the right-hand side, we have a serial number and validity period that we can pick ourselves. Now, the computation will be put into the RSA key part, and that will just look random. And then the rest will be exactly the same. Both the 509 extensions and, most importantly, the signatures will be the same. So, Alex?
Yeah. All right. So now we're up to 2008. And in 2008, David Molnar, Jake, and I started looking into SSL and thinking about ways you can break it. We came across the paper that the other members of our team had published, and at that point we did not know them. But we realized that we would need these kinds of techniques in order to execute this attack. So through David Molnar, we got in touch with the other guys, and they graciously agreed to collaborate with us on doing this attack. The problem that they had in 2006 was that doing this attack against a real certificate authority was complicated by the serial number and the validity period in the certificate. remember that the first parts are the chosen prefix, and we need to have those two prefixes from the two certificates. We need to know them before we can start generating the collision, and generating the collision takes a long time. So the validity period and the serial number, which are set by the CA, are set when the certificate is issued, so we would not know what they are in advance. And if we can predict them, then we would be able to execute this attack against a real certificate authority. In 2006, they were using their own certificate authority just for testing purposes, which had predictable serial numbers and validity periods. So the main problem that we had to solve in 2008 in order to really do this attack was figuring out how to predict the serial number and the validity period from a real certificate authority. Of course, the first step, which was much easier, was looking at which certificate authorities are still using AMD5 in 2008. We did this by collecting a large amount of certificates from random websites on the internet. And based on those certificates, we identified six different certificate authorities that had issued certificates signed with AMD5 in 2008. We looked at most of those certificate authorities, and the one that we decided to investigate more closely was RapidSSL. First, because 97% of the MD5 certificates we found were issued by RapidSSL, so they seemed like a pretty big target. But also because RapidSSL turned out to have some pretty convenient properties of their system that were very useful to us to do this attack. The first property was that their system for issuing certificates was completely automated, which meant that you submit the certificate, you go through a validation process, they send you an email with a confirmation link, you go to that website, and then you have this I approve button. The certificate is always issued exactly 6 seconds after you click that I approve button, which means that the attacker controls the validity period of the certificate, the date at which it is issued, and its length. You choose the length of the validity by selecting if you want a 1-year certificate or a 2-year certificate, and then the date when it's issued, you just pick whatever date you want, and you have to click that button at the exact right time. And in my initial testing, I was actually doing this by hand. I had like a stopwatch, and then I would keep my finger on the mouse button, and right as the second hand hit, you know, the zero, then I clicked the button, and I got my certificate issued. And even doing this manually over a pretty slow DSL connection gave us enough accuracy to be able to get certificates issued at the exact second we needed almost always. Now, the second problem was, how do we predict the serial numbers? Well, yeah. Based on the reaction from the audience, I'm assuming that I don't really need to explain much. But yes, for those of you who are listening on the radio, the serial numbers are actually sequential. So RapidSSL just keeps a counter, and for each certificate that they issue, they increment the counter by one. In this case, you can see a bunch of certificates that we have bought and the serial numbers that we got for them. If you look at the timestamps on the left side, you'll also see that almost all of them are issued at exactly 2 seconds past the minute. And this is because we were targeting that exact second. So this helps us a little bit, but we need to be able to predict what the serial number is going to be, not in the next minute, but about 3 days ahead of time. Because we estimated that it was going to take us 3 days to generate the colliding certificates using the big cluster of PlayStation 3s. So how do we estimate what the serial number is going to be in 3 days? Well, we can actually get the current value of the serial number at any time. We just need to buy a certificate, and this allows us to query the current value of the serial number. It also increments the serial number. So we have a query and increment operation that we can perform on this remote counter. And because of the money they charge for the certificates, each query and increment operation costs $2.25. So you want to be right the first time if you can, otherwise you might have to spend some money. I looked at the, I think, 9,000 certificates from RapidSSL that we had collected. We did some advanced statistical analysis using Excel. And this is a graph that shows the increment of the serial number over a weekend. You can't really see the y-axis because it's cut off on the screen, but the two horizontal lines, the upper bound and the lower bound of the increment, are 800 and 1,000. This means that pretty reliably, RapidSSL issues between 800 and 1,000 certificates each weekend, from beginning of Friday to Sunday night. So if we get a certificate on Friday night, we'll get the serial number. Then we can predict that on Sunday night, the serial number is going to be S plus 1,000. And this is going to be an upper bound. We're going to start generating our collision. This is going to take a couple of days. Hopefully, we'll have it done by Sunday. On Sunday, we need to get that certificate signed at the exact time that we target it. This is time T. And we need to ensure that we get serial number S plus 1,000. So a couple of hours before time T, we start buying certificates. This allows us to both query the number and also increment it as necessary. So if we see that it's maybe 200 lower than it should be, then we can just buy 200 certificates. Of course, while we do this, we need to monitor what the number is, because the serial number is also incremented by requests sent by other customers of the CA. But since we chose Sunday night to do this attack, the load on the CA was fairly low. So it did not interfere with our targeting too much. So this was the attack. This was the basic algorithm for the attack. Everybody just loves these PlayStations. I mean, you know that they're not actually running games on those. They're not that fun. They just have terminals with stuff scrolling. So this is a picture of the cluster that we used, and it would take between 1 and 2 days to generate a collision on it. We estimated that it's equivalent to about $20,000 of computing time using the Amazon EC2 system, which is fairly significant cost, but you know, definitely affordable for anybody who really cares about having a rogue certificate authority. There's one more improvement that we made upon the original 2006 attack. And this was a fairly important improvement for the impact of the attack, because in 2006, we could only generate certificates for a specific website. So if you wanted to man-in-the-middle example.com, you have to spend these 3 days generating the collision for example.com, get it signed at the right time. But then you can only man-in-the-middle example.com. You cannot man-in-the-middle anything else. What we did now is we manipulated the structure of the certificates to make our rogue certificate into a intermediate certificate authority. Remember the graph that Jake showed on one of the previous slides where you had the tree of the certificates? You have the root certificate authority, which is the one that RapidSSL uses. And we have a signature from that to our rogue cert. And our rogue cert is an intermediate certificate authority, which has the ability to sign any other cert that's located under it in the tree. This gives us the full power of having a certificate authority. And we only need to do the attack once. because once we have the CA cert, we can use it indefinitely, or at least until it expires. So the way we did this is we fit the entire rogue CA cert into the first 500 bytes of the certificate, which in the real cert were taken up by the name. We used a very long domain name for our cert to get the alignment right. And if you look at the t-shirts that my colleagues are wearing, you'll see the domain name. It's exactly 64 characters, which is the maximum number allowed. And I don't know if you can see it very well, but it says, I broke the internet and all I got was this t-shirt, .freedom.org. This is a legitimate domain that I own, and we obtained the legitimate certificate was for that domain. And then we could copy the signature from it into the fake or into the rogue certificate. One other extra point. We still had to have the bottom parts of the legitimate certificate copied into the fake certificate, but we had to get the browsers to ignore them when they received the rogue certificate. So we used a very long Netscape comment extension, which allows you to put basically arbitrary data into the certificate. It's ignored by the browser, so it doesn't cause any problems. So with this, we're able to generate a rogue CA certificate. It only took us 4 attempts. This means 4 weekends. We did it every weekend over a month. The main problems we had were with timing. Sometimes we would not get the certificate issued at the exact second that we needed, but 1 second later. Sometimes somebody else would just come in right before our request and steal our serial number. It would actually be interesting to spider the web again to try to find the website that has that serial number in. I don't know what we'll do to them. But the total cost of all the certificates we had to buy was actually only $657, which is not too bad. This was because RapidSSL allowed us to reissue each certificate up to 20 times. So we actually only paid $45, but that was for 20 certificates. The cost was not prohibitive at all. So what can we do having this certificate? Jake is going to tell you more about it.
So I already went into this a little bit, but this is an example if you haven't gone to the website or you don't have a laptop. This is what the chain looks like. There's a couple of interesting things here. One is that it's valid. That's probably obvious. But the other is that we named our certificate authority MD5 Collisions Incorporated. If you look through the certificate authority list and you actually see intermediate SSL certificates in the wild, they have crazy names that you can never imagine, or they have like some corporation's name, but like some sub-business unit of it or something like this. And so it's totally reasonable in the wild to see a certificate chain like this. And so what you can do with that is essentially be one of those sub-business units. And it's just business as usual in the X509 commercial world. So we, of course, chose a name that would be funny. Other people could choose a name that was... Yes, you're not laughing. Well, it's hard to impress these guys. So you could choose any name that you'd like. And, of course, this is extremely difficult to understand which business units are actually real, which ones are not. And also, the cute thing about this is that when we say perfect man-in-the-middle attacks, we talked about mitigating this with some vendors. And essentially, they said, well, you need to do these things. That's difficult. Maybe. I'm not so sure about that. So who here use wireless networks? I mean, these things could be bad. But they said, well, we can check for certificates that end with MD5. And actually, the way that this works, we can sign with whatever hashing algorithm we like. So our rogue CA man-in-the-middle tool, it just goes ahead and signs with the secure SHA-1 to make sure that you know that you're secure. So there are some countermeasures here. The spoof for what? Yeah, I just heard it's easy. Yeah. Anyway, I'm sure that if you had the private key, you would be able to pull off all the things like ARP spoofing and so on. However, we have some discussions about this, and we are not releasing the private key. I'm very sorry to say that to you guys, because I know that you probably would like it very much. But again, we also wanted to make sure that we were going to be able to prevent harm from this certificate, because we want to make the internet a more secure place. And yeah, I know, I believe that too. That's what gets the laugh out of them. Great, not push on one thing. So for, like I said earlier, the CA cert is backdated to 2004. So with the exception of really, really buggy software, you should not have to worry that even if it were to escape into the wild, that it would actually be useful for, like, you know, real-time, 100% secure phishing or things like this. We've also contacted a couple of vendors in advance in order to give them the fingerprint and the certificate and a proof of concept for them so that they can see that this is real and they can blacklist our certificate. You might be able to blacklist the certificate yourself. There's been some infrastructure in place for this, different tools for Debian, for example, that are floating around on the internet. You could plug in the fingerprint for the certificate as well. So,
all right, so the obvious thing that the certificate authorities could do without a certificate is try to revoke it. This is one of the responsibilities. If they issue a illegitimate certificate, they have to revoke it. However, it turns out that our certificate is not revocable. This was not intentional. We only figured this out once we had already acquired the certificate. But apparently both the CRL and the OCSP protocols, which are used for revocation, rely on the certificate itself to tell the browser where to check for revocation. There's a special URL that the browser uses to contact the revocation server. So if the certificate does not have such a URL, the browser just doesn't know how to check for revocation, so it does not. Our cert doesn't include this URL just because we had to fit everything into 500 bytes, and we didn't have space to include any of these extra extensions. But even if you could get revocation, you know, if for some reason we had this revocation URL, the fact is a lot of browsers, Firefox 2 and also Internet Explorer 6, don't check for revocation by default. Apparently this is because of infrastructure problems, load on the certificate authorities. They couldn't figure out how to make servers that can withstand all of these internet users checking for revocation. So a lot of older browsers don't check for revocation. The newer browsers do check, but they still have the problem with not being able to find the revocation URL in our certificate. The only thing that could possibly help to check for revocation is this option that both Firefox and Internet Explorer have. It allows people to set up their own OCSP servers which respond to revocation requests, and large organizations can do this. For example, they set up their own server, they configure all of their browsers to ask this server for revocation, and then the browser always asks that server and ignores the URL that comes from the certificate itself, or the lack of URL in the certificate. However, this is not something that individual users could do. So the revocation is still an open problem, and revocation for SSL certificates has been a pretty serious issue, even regardless of our work. So you can't really rely on revocation. EVCerts are something that will help you if you actually understand the difference between EVCerts and normal certs, if you know where to look to find that difference. They're called extended validation certs, and they have more stringent requirements. And the EV certificate authorities have never used MD5 to issue these certs. So if you find a certificate chain that ends with a EV certificate authority, then it could not have been attacked using this method. However, users don't really understand what EV means, and it's kind of hard to tell whether you're looking at a normal cert or an EV cert. For example,
Firefox 2, when you would go to an SSL website, it would make the URL bar gold, right? So we knew to teach people, look for the padlock, look for the gold URL bar, we know that we have a secure site. So that became like a value add thing. This like simple UI indicator that was like almost helping to get people to even understand that they were using something that was called security on the internet. And basically in Firefox 3 and other certificate aware programs, usually they have like a special little box to the left-hand side of the URL that says the company's name and maybe like green, and then the URL bar isn't colored anymore. So depending on which web browser your grandmother or grandfather is using, you tell them, oh, you look for the green box in the upper left-hand corner of the URL bar, or you look for the gold strip. And maybe that's kind of difficult to tell people. Yeah, and on the Mac, it's on the bottom. So like depending on the browser, it's just like, it's kind of a disaster. And of course, the EV certificates exist alongside these other certificate authorities, and you're really only as secure as this, the weakest link. And since there aren't constraints on what the Brazilian government certificate authority can issue, for example, or RapidSSL, if any one of them goes, they all go. And that's pretty bad. And so extended validation is certainly a good road into the future, but it still has the problems of the commercial X509 certificate authority industry.
Yes, so now we're concerned. We did this attack, but might anybody else redo our attack? Well, we've made some figures, and with some further optimizations, we actually estimate that our attack can be done for $2,000 renting computing power at Amazon EC2, and just a single day, so that's available for anybody. And having this in mind, yeah, we want to take extra precautions to prevent anybody else to just easily redo our attack. So for that reason, we are not going to release our collision finding implementation or our improved methods for doing the chosen prefix collision until we feel it's safe to do so. And we've talked to the affected CAs, and they've acknowledged that they will switch to SHA-1 very, very soon. So that's very good news for us, that we've made a good impact in better security on the internet. But there's another question. I mean, our paper has been available since 2007, so anybody could have already implemented everything that's in the paper, maybe even made the same improvements as we did, and have done also did this attack for just like $2,000 on the Amazon EC2 system. Well, how can we tell if this happened? Well, there is no way to tell. The theory has been public since 2007, and our legitimate certificate is just, it's completely legitimate. We own the domain. It's just completely valid certificate request, and we followed proper protocol, and there is nothing you can see at the certificate that there is something wrong there. So there is an open question from, can we trust CAs that have used MD5 to sign certificates this year or even years before? Can we still trust them? And that's something we can't answer.
So where do we go from here? Well, our attack is kind of interesting, I think, we hope. Somebody doesn't agree. So we have done this attack, and the certificate authorities will switch to SHA-1 fairly soon. It's kind of interesting that it actually took them. It took a real practical attack that was actually executed to get them to finally switch. Apparently publishing the theory and publishing all these papers that prove that it's possible to do it was not enough, which is kind of sad. But one thing that we would recommend for certificate authorities and just any software system is to implement defense in depth. For example, if RapidSSL had had random serial numbers, which some other certificate authorities do, or if they had implemented a random delay when signing certs, which is a commonly recommended best practice when doing crypto and signing operations, we would not have been able to do this attack. And nobody else would have been able to do this attack using this method, because you cannot predict something that's random, if it's random enough. These defense in depth techniques are even more important when you think about what could happen in the future. I mean, there are people who are working on second preimage attacks against MD5. There's also people who are working on SHA-1 collisions, and those things might or might not happen. But if they do happen, they will probably happen overnight. So what do we do when we wake up one day and suddenly SHA-1 is no longer secure, and you can do the exact same attack against certificate authorities that use SHA-1, which at this point is practically 100% of them? Well, it turns out that dropping support for these cryptographic primitives is very, very hard. You have a lot of backwards compatibility issues, a lot of clients that cannot be upgraded. You know, maybe you have mobile devices that just have a harder implementation of an algorithm, and they're not even powerful enough to do it in software. So there's just no way to replace a hash function with another one without replacing the entire device. Also, who is responsible for the cost of replacing these devices? Do users have to go and buy a new phone every time that a cryptographic hash function gets broken? So these are open questions. We don't really have very good answers to them. Random serial numbers and random delay when signing certs are definitely things we recommend that certificate authorities do to stop this attack. But definitely a lot more defense in depth research is needed on how to prevent other cryptographic attacks on actually becoming from actually becoming practical. Do you want to add something about that?
One thing that happened with Debian, and sorry to beat on you guys so hard, is that a lot of CAs were able to find that keys were weak. They were able to detect that the keys were weak, which, as we've already said, is not really possible here, or we don't know how to do it exactly. CAs offered reissues. They said, you know, you generated this with a bad version of OpenSSL. This is clearly not your fault, but we don't want to tarnish our brand. We want things to be something more positive, so we'll reissue this certificate. And so, in theory, the certificate authorities that bear some responsibility for using broken hash functions 4 years after they were broken could, for example, reissue certificates using a secure hashing function, and that would be reasonable. Now, who knows if they'll actually do that? But that's something that could be done that would be kind of useful. And it's not so simple as to simply remove the certificate authority routes that issue with MD5, because essentially you would get rid of the only useful property that the CAs offer, and about 30% of the internet potentially would have invalid SSL certificates according to your browser. So it's a little bit difficult to simply move forward from here as well. So I was going to take the slide about, you know, has someone else done this, because I'm the group conspiracy theorist or something, according to Alex. And, I think that it's not unreasonable to imagine that well-funded adversaries are also very intelligent and could do this. I don't know. I certainly don't trust any certificates that use MD5 anymore at all. So, I mean, at least, you know, for the end leaf certificate, which I've already said doesn't matter anyway, but you know, that's the best you can do. We talked to some companies that helped us talk to the affected certificate authority, and they're going to switch to SHA-1 sometime in soon. So they have there's a window of opportunity there, so don't take it. You'll do what you're going to do. So in theory, with SHA-1, this is something that is going to stop until SHA-1 falls, and it might very well. And in this case, we really think that it was necessary to practically demonstrate this attack and do a real attack against an actual certificate authority. I'm hesitant to use the term attack, but essentially, we wanted to show that it was possible, because it seems like in the industry, people, or the computer security industry, people generally are not looking at academia to see what problems are already solved. And so even though there are some companies that have really tight security and do a really good job, they're placed alongside with some company that might have just paid $25,000 to be assured by some sort of agency that does assurances and says this is a good certificate authority. And so we needed to show this, we felt, so that people would be able to understand that this attack was not theoretical. It wasn't an academic ivory tower discussion. It's very real. And there are interesting discussions to be had about how certificate authorities get inserted into different operating systems and browsers, but, which isn't necessarily for here. But you should look at them and question them.
All right. So finally, we'd like to thank a few people. We've worked very closely with the EFF on this, particularly Jennifer Granick and Joe Gratz, who is actually here in the audience. They were very helpful with various legal issues surrounding this research. We also had lawyers from all the other organizations, CWI, TU Eindhoven, and EPFL. Sometimes coordinating between all of those was pretty complicated, but we managed to do it. We also got some help from Dan Kaminsky, who graciously assisted me with collecting SSL certificates. He had done a lot of that before when he was working on his DNS bug. Also, Ralph Philip Weinman for actually inspiring this research by sending an email to Jake and David, I believe pointing out the certificate was using MD5 for Jake, and Jake can probably tell the story.
Essentially, there was an IRC conversation that we had, which is like where the birth of all great ideas come from, right? So we had this conversation, and it occurred to David and I that this is something that we should look into. And really, if it wasn't for Ralph, I don't think that I would even be interested in cryptography at all. So he's really like the most awesome guy in the world, and you should all shower him with praise. He's the tall, dark, handsome guy in the middle. So we'd also like to thank Len Sassaman and Meredith Patterson, who are just badass cypherpunks and, in general, really, really awesome. We really respect them a great deal. And they have also talked with us about this, and this is something that is quite interesting to them as well. Microsoft was incredibly interesting to work with. Okay. So... So we did something different for this talk. We were concerned about possible legal ramifications of pulling this attack off. And we were very secretive about it up front because the biggest risk that we felt was the risk of being gagged for being a security researcher trying to tell the world about something that might undermine the bottom line of a corporation. Yeah, good sentence there. So what we did was we asked Microsoft and Mozilla to sign non-disclosure agreements. See, generally, it's the researcher that has this fear, legal fear, about talking to people. And what we wanted to do was make sure that Microsoft and Mozilla and anyone else involved did not leak this to the certificate authority who might try to gag us if they knew who we were. So we turned that on its head. And we hope that other security researchers will also do this. And they will protect themselves in a way where other companies will want to know about these things and they will be treated with respect and dignity in both directions. And so that the researchers don't have to fear when they're coming forward to actually make things better, when they're trying to improve the security of things, when they're trying to essentially be, a whistleblower for things that are just egregiously wrong in the processes that are in place on the internet. And Microsoft took a little bit of time to come around, but they did, and they were really quite gracious about it. And Mozilla signed up immediately. They were fabulous to deal with. And it was really quite nice to work with vendors where they were sort of a little bit in awe and they were kind of unsure what to do next. And they'll probably both issue patches. We're not actually sure what patches, or what they're going to do. They haven't necessarily told us anything other than possibly blacklisting our certificate. But that's something that I think is worth everyone here who does any sort of research consider that this is something that you might want to do if you feel that it's necessary. Obviously, it's not a good idea to just flood companies with non-disclosure requests because that will completely undermine this process. But if you really are afraid that you might be targeted for legal action, you can ask them to have a sort of a mutual leap of faith, I guess. So that's something worthwhile. And yeah, oh, and also the New World Order, apparently.
Government. Yeah, lastly, we have the SNF and the NWO. That's our respectively the Swiss and the Dutch government funding for the academic research. So I have to mention them.
So hopefully now you guys will have some questions, and also I'm going to make sure that the wireless live man in the middle demo thing here will actually work now that I don't have to use that as my terminal, which is really fabulous. So if you guys or gals have any questions, we would love to answer them for you now. So feel free to line up the microphones and we will answer your questions.
Hi, do you have a complete list somewhere of CAs that are using MD5 should we choose to want to remove them from our browsers and everything else and then be left with manually giving exceptions to leaf if we actually trust that website?
So this is in our paper, but this is, as I said, complicated. For example, some of the very root certificate authorities signed themselves with MD5 but no longer issue with MD5. And there's an important distinction to be made there because what that means for you is that you see an MD5 signature in the chain of trust, but it isn't the last one, and it might be the first one, it might be the second one, and it may be legitimate, it may not be legitimate. And if and when someone has second pre-image attacks, that becomes an even worse problem. But again, disabling them takes a good swath of the value out of any SSL at all.
Also, you have to keep in mind that if you remove the rapid SSL root, for example, this will break, according to the collection of certs that we got, this will break about 30% of the secure websites on the internet, which is a pretty significant number. So perhaps removing them outright is not the best option for everybody.
Sorry, I have a question. Any of the code signing certificates in the Windows operating system signed with MD5?
We haven't really looked into that. So, I don't know.
I have another question. Have these vendors in any way excluded commercial liability for the certificates they provide, especially since this attack has been known since 2007? In other words, given that you don't know that this is happening, or you have no definitive proof, you saw the lock and you were doing your electronic banking and money disappeared. Have these banks now somebody to sue? Can they sue their certificate providers for signing with MD5 even though they knew? In other words, you were saying we don't know when they're going to upgrade. How true is that?
Well, we're not lawyers ourselves, so we can't really comment on any legal issues. Just based on my practical experience, I'm pretty sure that all of these certificate authorities have wording somewhere that says we're not responsible for anything. All of those big EULAs that you click through without even reading usually say that. The demo URL? Yes. It's i.broke.theinternet, or it has dots between every word, so it's I broke the internet and all I got was this t-shirt.
Okay, so my question is, should we treat all CA public keys with an obvious padding, such as the comment block, as suspect? Or would this be a way to detect if anyone pulled off the stunt before?
Well, this will detect... Okay, so there are two certificates. There is the legitimate one that you send to the CA, which the CA might keep a copy of, and then there is the rogue one. You're not going to see the rogue, nobody will see the rogue one until it's used, and it might be used only against a... You want to answer that? Okay. Oh. Okay, I was confused about what was going on. Nobody will see the rogue certificate until it's used against them, so it could be a very targeted attack. If you do see a certificate with a long Netscape comment field that has a bunch of random-looking data in it, yeah, that is suspicious. However, there are many other fields that an attacker can use. This is just what we chose for our proof of concept. Somebody else can just construct their certificate in a slightly different way. So it's hard to tell. It's hard to tell whether you're whether you're being attacked using this method. Also, if the attackers only do if they only do the attack where they get a collision for a website, so they don't have a rogue CA, they just have a rogue website certificate, then the only difference is going to be in the name of the site, and the collision bits are going to be hidden in the RSA key, which looks random anyways, so it's not going to be possible to really tell if it's been part of this attack or not. So, yes, our certificate you can probably detect just by looking at it very carefully, but you can certainly do the attack in other ways that are much harder to detect.
One thing that I've toyed with a little bit, though it certainly isn't perfect, is the idea of creating, you know, free software that would allow you to have some sort of alternate trust metric. Like, for example, in the past, we've looked at other ways of evaluating whether a certificate is actually valid by looking from different points on the internet. This is an experimental project that's called Perspectives. And essentially, well, we don't necessarily make a recommendation of this. The idea itself is very appealing to me. Which is that perhaps the signature is of a particular weight, and perhaps the fact that you can see it from 80 places on the internet is also of a particular weight. And perhaps because you also trust that certificate authority, it's very useful. But the way that we do it, Matt Blaze has a great quote. He says, basically, commercial security companies only protect you against people who they won't take money from. So if you think about what that means, I'm butchering the quote there, but if you think about what that means, commercial certificate authorities, even if they do switch to SHA-1, that doesn't mean that they're perfect. And it doesn't mean that you've found all of the CA routes on your machine, because your web browser might use one and your IRC client might use another. And so it's worth considering that it's a very complex issue as to how CA certs end up on your computer and why you end up trusting them. And even like the concept of security based on X5 unknown signatures is questionable to some extent. So this is the URL where you can read about all of the technical things that we're releasing right now, as well as the proofs, the certificates, and so forth. And it also links to some other documents, so they're worth reading. Any other questions? You, Mr. WikiLeaks.
Wait. Thank you for this great talk. If the certificate has already been cached by a browser or accessed by a browser, and the certificate chain changes, which is what is happening in your attack, and would also happen for rogue CAs, not of your type, but the regular commercial ones, which are all around, will any of the browsers report the change in the certificate change?
So the short answer is no. Implementation detail here is that I wrote some modifications to a tool that a friend of mine wrote, SSLSniff, and one of the issues was that the tool was originally used for exploiting basic constraints vulnerabilities in Microsoft Internet Explorer a couple years back. They didn't respect that, so you could easily do this. And I had some trouble with the man in the middle of the tool at first because Firefox cares about the serial number when you have like serial numbers of different certificates. But it turns out if you just generate a random serial number that the browser has never seen before, then the browser accepts it as the new certificate and it doesn't care about it at all. And so for practical exploitation, that means that if you can't tell that the certificate is invalid from another way, that serial number is not a protection. And it wasn't designed as a protection either. It's just maybe even a bug in Firefox, because Opera, for example, doesn't care. Internet Explorer doesn't care. None of the IRC or mail clients that we tested cared at all.
If somebody has such a certificate which uses MD5, do you advise to exchange it immediately?
Dude. I need WikiLeaks to my rescue. So I think that as a, good citizen of the internet, or whatever you want to call that, I think that it's reasonable that the only way we're going to ever get rid of MD5 is if we each personally eradicate the little bit of MD5 in our lives. The fact of the matter is, if 30% of the internet is using certificates with MD5, it's a really difficult economic problem. It doesn't go in the right direction. Certificate authorities have the right direction to clean it up, but they don't necessarily want to issue 30% of the internet's SSL certificates again for free. So we all have to pressure the certificate authorities that do this to change this, to go to SHA-1, but also to pressure them and ask them questions. For example, when you go to an SSL certificate authority and you want to buy a certificate, you don't know that they don't sign with MD5 when you purchase it. It's difficult to find certificate authority information. And so that's perhaps another issue. Maybe you'll go somewhere and you'll still get an MD5 signature from a different vendor. So it's a difficult problem, but I think that we can solve it by collectively, asking for it, I guess, or rejecting them entirely. Depends on your perspective. So thank you very much for your time. It's been an honor to speak to all of you.